This evening I ask you the question, should Christians be environmentalists? The reason I bring that particular subject up is that many people in our country today are looking toward religion. Some are claiming, such as Michael Creighton, when he was still alive, was saying that environmentalists, they have formed their own religion. Atheists have become environmentalists, and they have the religion, they have their guilt trip, they have the redemption, they have it all in place, connected with this environment. But in order, as we've seen, for a lot of this to take hold, and the different views that people have, and the solutions that people have, some have appealed to religion, for established from the Bible, that we should be in these particular groups, and trying to fight against global warming and all the things that you hear from time to time on the news. But when I look at the Bible and see the passages they use, I see it like in so many ways the Bible is perverted in order to establish a particular point of view. Now, I'd like to look at those passages first at the very beginning as an introductory way of getting into the lesson, but then to observe, what is our responsibility to our environment? Do we have any as being God's people? And we'll examine that. But here are some samples from religious people who are looking to the Bible to observe the fact that we need to be careful with our environment. And they go back to the first sin. The first sin, according to religious environmentalists, was the fact that they were involved in abusing and not holding to the authority of God, and the fact that they took the forbidden fruit. But they abused the fruit. That's the sin as well. And God condemned them for abusing the fruit. I ask you, what was the purpose of that fruit? Did it look good? Well, the woman saw that for that purpose. Was it good for food? That's kind of the purpose of fruit. And that's exactly what she saw it to be. And she ate it because it was good for food, and it was also there to make one wise. Just what purpose of that fruit did she abuse? I don't think she did any of that. But see, abusing the fruit, that fits well with environmentalism. And therefore, we use the Bible to say that we should be environmentalists. Another passage is Jeremiah, the second chapter, and verse 7. Because here we observe people defiling the land. Defiling the land. That's what we're doing with industrialization. And though I brought you into a plentiful land to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof, but when ye entered, ye defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. No one seems to look at the context of such a passage as this. So how did they defile the land? Oh, you defile it. You run your industrialization over it. You have your big carbon footprint upon it. You defile the land and God's displeased. Ladies and gentlemen, in Jeremiah, the second chapter, what they're doing is following and going after idolatry and worshiping the idols and worshiping that and defiling the land because indeed they are going against God and having their own God. And in fact, in verse 8, the priests said not, where is Jehovah? And they that handled the law knew me not. And the rulers also transgressed against me. And the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things that do not profit. You defile the land in the Old Testament by taking innocent life. You defile the land in the Old Testament by walking after idolatry. But he has nothing to say here that you defile the land by using it for its own purpose and using its resources. He doesn't say that's defiling the land, but that's the message. And if you want to be a Christian and you want to abide by the Bible, you need to get on board. Because God says we defile my land, that's a sin. My question is how? The Bible gives us that context. Here's a passage, a sobering one. In Jeremiah, the fourth chapter, verses 23 through 26. If you ever thought about going backwards, Jeremiah prophesies of this, that when we are involved in bringing damage upon the land when creation suffers. It suffers from our human sin. And Jeremiah is talking about sin, and here's what happens. Verse 23. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was waste and void. And the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountain, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved to and fro. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of heaven were fled. And I beheld, lo, the fruitful field was a wilderness. And all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of Jehovah and before his fierce anger. You're digressing to the time in which the world was first created. You're going back to that. And therefore, when Jeremiah speaks of the sins of the people, he looks at the land going back to fruitful land to a wilderness. Sounds like apocalyptic story, doesn't it? It sounds like what you do when you defile the land. And when man sins, creation suffers. Jeremiah 4 is a great passage for religious environmentalists who say we need to go back to the Bible. And the Bible will teach us that we need to join in that particular agenda. Isaiah, the 5th chapter and verse 8, is along that same line when we are observing the idea of man suffering. And here's industrialization for you. Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no room, and ye be made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. In mine ears said Jehovah of hosts of truth, my houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. So here's the idea of the land not producing. Why? Because you built your homes and you had one house right after another. Sounds like modern industrialization, doesn't it? Sounds like what we do in our particular cities and in our suburbs. And you build house, 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 and you just devour the land. See, that's the points that are being made. And taking the Bible. Ladies and gentlemen, all Isaiah is saying, that you greedy people, not that having one house after another in a particular neighborhood is sinful, but that you're going in your greed, you cry one piece of land right after another to the point you are the only one that's there. He said, I'm going to bring you down. And Isaiah speaks in the context of people being greedy over their fellow man, not their fellow chipmunks. It's being greedy over the things of acquiring things from people by their own oppressive ways. Not that we're rooting out the owl. We're causing a great world hunger because we're building one house right next to another. But that's the concept. And they find these passages. Forget the context. And we realize, yes, we need to be on board. We need to be involved in whatever the environmentalists say. Because the Bible is speaking out against us defiling the land. I want you to observe, just like Bible is used to promote the social gospel, just like the Bible is used for different reasons to promote whatever our agenda is, that in our day and time from the 1970s, liberal religious people have been involved and being involved in this, but trying to find some basis from the Bible by which they could promote their agenda. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't care about this planet called Earth? Does that mean that we should not care about it? Here's some of the extremes that you see on the other side. You know, 2 Peter 3:10 said this world's going to be destroyed by fire and it's going to end and it's a dying world and it is going to end, so let's use it all up the best we can because it's not going to last. So let's use it up for ourselves. And that's not an attitude to have. And the Bible doesn't teach that. So I want to look at exactly what the Bible says about man's place in his environment. In this place called Earth. We go back to the beginning of creation. Notice that everything was created before man. Why? Because man was going to use the resources of this world. The plants were made. The animals were made. And after all those things are in place, And after the vegetation is producing after its kind, and those things are set, who was to benefit from it? The last one created, and that was man. Alexander Campbell made a great observation. I think it's true from looking at the Bible, that the things of most importance are the things that are last in place, are the last seen and fulfilled. Heaven is the most important. That's the last thing that we'll be going to. Man is more important than the animals and the creation and the plants and the vegetation. What was foremost in God's mind was the last thing in execution. And what's foremost in God's mind is heaven. And that'll be the last thing in execution. Well, that's the same thing with creation. Well, what can I learn in principle from that? I know one thing that the Bible said to do. That we read in Genesis, the first chapter, when he made man. In Genesis, the first chapter, in verse 27. He says, I want you to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. I think man's done a good job about that. I think we have gone to the world, unless there's some more places upon this earth that we were not there yet. And that may be true, that we can inhabit. But man has done that. And of course, man wasn't willing to fulfill that. We have the Tower of Babel to get them spread out. They wanted to do their own thing and have their own glory. But we find that that's the case. But here's the next passage. The next word says, subdue it. It is interesting, and you do some study upon your own. When you read that, from a biblical standpoint, environmentalist, that means to build up the creation. That means you ought to build it up and make it flourish. That's not what this word means. It never does. It means to subdue. It means to bring under bondage. It implies that indeed what you're subduing is an adversarial force. And if you have to subdue it by force, you do so. Now that's probably not politically correct to say. And I don't want to take it to extremes. But let's deal with the Bible. Let's deal with what the words actually mean that God chose to use. And you see the flavor of this word in Joshua 18 and verse 1, when the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled themselves together at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. There remained in the children of Israel 7 tribes which had not divided their inheritance. It was subdued. They had conquered it. And they had to do so by force. Jeremiah 34 and verse 11 speaks about when the people let their servants and their slaves go. Then they changed their mind and brought them back and they subdued them. What do you think's happening? Well, we're building them up and making them feel good. Now we're bringing them back under control. Here's an interesting passage where that word is used in Micah, the 7th chapter in verse 19, regarding our sins. Please listen to the American Standard's translation of this word, subdue. Kabosh. He says, he will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. That's our word, subdue. He will tread our iniquities underfoot, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. It's like he's bringing it down under control, treading under his foot, and he's going to throw them in the sea. That's a blessing called forgiveness. But he uses that picture where he used that word subdue. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me caution you. Does that mean, well, I'm to bring it under control and therefore I can trash it? No. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we live in pretty soft places. You want to get out in nature? You want to be like the little girl that got out into a Florida swamp and spent 5 days there eating up with bugs? And being about alligator bait for 5 days and worried about her well-being, she just a little bit away from home. We're so close to nature, and nature is not real. It's not real conducive for things. And I think there's hardship in nature. I'm watching a dove, a mother dove, sit on her eggs. I said, what a boring existence. We read 14 days, maybe 18 at the tops. Well, it's been 14 days, and she stays there and stays there and stays there. She worked hard to make that nest. And I thought, what a hardship that you had. And just a few feet, I'm in an air-conditioned place, and I look out and see how you're doing. But her life, she doesn't complain. She's a bird. But I'm thinking, that's nature. And animals eat other animals. And it's not real conducive, but this is just wonderful. And you know, when you see the apocalyptic stories about what happens because we have ignored our creation, what happens? The world doesn't end. New York does. And the world is covered by flood. It's going to go back to where it was. It's going to be fine. You ever seen anything where the world ends? No, the world as we know it ends. But you never see this earth that we're supposed to care so much about, and we got to handle it with care. It's going to live on after us, according to the stories of the environmentalist. What we observe here is that God says, I want you to subdue it, not trash it. But you bring it under force, if you have to. You bring it, and here's the concept. It is the idea, it is made to serve you. And sometimes you may have to make it serve you by force. Servants. That's the concept of the word. But see, I never see that in the biblical literature for environmentalism. And when they say it, they mean build it up. Now, they bring it down under control of man. And he put man in position for that. Well, that's not the only place. Turn to Psalm 8 and verse 6, where the Bible speaks about where man is. And man's been made a little lower than God. He crowns him with glory and honor. And said, thou makest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. We've got a word called dominion. How are you going to look at that? Dominion. Well, I think we find ourselves as the prominent ones in regard to the works of God's hands. Because we see that word in Genesis 1 and verse 18. Let's take man out of the picture and let's observe the word in a context where we have the sun and the moon. In Genesis 1 and verse 18, he says to rule, verse 17, God set them in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule, there's our word dominion, to rule over the day and over the night. And to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. When you look up into the sky at night, where's the prominent fixture up there? You see the moon, you see the stars. They're having dominion over that. You get wide awake in the next morning, you see the sun, you don't look at it, it's too bright. But I tell you, the sun rules. It's dominant. And that's exactly, it says, I place man to be the dominant one. Not cowering to all the different animals and idealist man go back to the the 7th century and get rid of all these things because we're killing the planet and all those things. It's not making man dominant. But God says that's where I want him to be. Not trashing it, but subduing it and having dominion over it. Now let's look at some other passages that deal with our relationship. Because what we see is that when man was placed in the garden, he wasn't placed there to sit in the hammock all day and eat, drink water and lemonade or whatever you have and just sit back and do nothing. He was there to work. And the words that he uses there are two Hebrew words. In Genesis 2nd chapter and verse 5, he was to dress it and to keep it. Those words mean something. That's part of his relationship with his environment. That's his world that he lived in. What do those words mean? First of all, it means to till it. And that's how it's used in Isaiah the 19th chapter and verse 9, where we're involved with thread and the things we're bringing forth these things, making clothes. You're working it. And the idea of working whatever it is, the ground or the vineyard or the threads of your clothes, that's involved in doing that. But also involves the idea of guarding it, looking over, keeping the flock. Jacob was willing to do for Laban, to do that. David left his wives back in the home to keep, to guard, to oversee with great care the houses that he led. And so this idea of guarding and the idea of keeping it is that idea of exercising great care over it. And even in the context of the first end, remember when the angel is placed into the garden to guard, to keep the way of that tree of life? Guard it. Am I my brother's keeper? What was that? Am I supposed to exercise care over him? That's the concept of that word. And so, you know, I don't trash the world I live in. I exercise great care over it. I have dominion. I am going to be involved in bringing it under the control for the benefit of creation and benefit of man. There's nothing sinful about that. But also, I'm going to till it, work the land. I'm going to be guarding it and taking care of it. Now, you think about the Israelites, and they would work their land, but the seventh year they let it rest. Why? So it could produce more for man. It was a way of dealing with the land, so it could restore its nutrients, so man could be blessed even more. That's God's wisdom. But that was man's idea and man's place in the garden. That's what God says that you're supposed to do. Thirdly, I want to say that we're to care for animals. Is this something that says, no, we're not caring for animals because we've got diesel gas out there in the fields? Some would say, this is horrible. This is our problem. This is the idea of man and his society and those poor little bovines out there. They're being diseased by diesel gas in that tank. Who said so? Well, it just doesn't look good. It's not natural. That's man having his carbon footprint right on that good old land where my cattle can be. Of course, have you thought about how much carbon dioxide comes from the rear end of those cattle? That cattle? A lot more we're producing. But no, we don't worry about that. Well, we do because we don't want you to eat cows now. And so we go from there. It goes all over the place, doesn't it? My question is, does the Bible teach we're how to care for animals? Or do we just say, forget it? I tell you, the Bible has a lot of examples. Proverbs, the 12th chapter and verse 12. Here's the wisdom that comes from God. And God says in Proverbs 12 and verse 10, the wise man tells, a righteous man regardeth the life of his beast. Notice it's his beast. He's in control. But the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. So regarding the life, what's involved? That tender mercies. You care for your beast. You take care of him. Secondly, you guard against the hardship of a beast. In Deuteronomy 25 and verse 4, you're not to muzzle the beast. You let him eat. What's he doing? He's treading out the corn so you can eat. You let him have some bites too. And you know, you weren't to let an ox and an ass work together. I think, why? Deuteronomy 22:10 says not to mix them together. A lot of it is because they'd be unequal workers. It'd be hardship upon one. Maybe upon the donkey, then the oxen. You want to put them together because you care for the beast. You care for animals. And the Bible gives those examples, especially in the Old Testament. Passage that I'm interested in. Deuteronomy 22:6-7, you respect birds when they're sitting on their eggs. You don't go in and rob the eggs and take the bird too. We'll just barbecue you while we're doing the other. No, you don't take both of them. And that was caring and respecting though the birds and the young that they're sitting upon. In Proverbs 27 and 23, we see the importance of looking well to the flocks. And I want us to notice that passage. When he says, be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks and look well to thy herds. Because animals are the dominant thing. Because animals are the most important thing. And man, you shouldn't use it for your own good. That's not what that context says. Let's put the verses around it. He said, for riches are not forever, and doth the crown endure unto all generations? The hay is gathered, the tender grass showeth itself, and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in. The lambs are for thy clothing, and the goats are the price of the field. There will be goat's milk enough for thy food, for the food of thy household, and maintenance for thy maidens. You'll give them work to do. You'll have milk. In fact, well, if I read the Bible correctly, that's the only milk that's authorized in the Bible, goat's milk. And I've never been drinking that. But that's the only one that's specified. There may be something to that. But what we're observing is the fact that in the context of looking well to your animals, man is in the picture. Modern environmentalism say he's in the picture a lot, but he needs to get out of it. That's not what the Bible teaches. He never takes man out of that dominion. And all these things are for his benefit. That what we see in the Word of God. I want to look at a psalm with you. Psalm 104. Because it ties God with his creation. And it ties man with his creation. We're all in this together. And when you look at the first 9 verses, God is distinct from his creation. Thou art clothed with honor and majesty, he says in the latter part of verse 1, who covers thyself with light as with a garment, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who maketh winds his messengers and flames of fire his ministers, who laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be moved forever, thou coverest with the deep as with a vesture. The waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At thy voice of thy thunder they hastened away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down upon to the place which thou hast founded for them. Thou hast set a bound that they may not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. But we're going to go back one day, and the earth's going to be covered with water because we're destroying it. Not so. Notice he's distinct from that. He lays the foundations. He's not the foundations. Nature is not Mother Nature. And he's all part of the nature. He uses it. There's his chariot. There's his ministers. He rides upon those things. He's different. He dresses it. Ladies and gentlemen, when you look at environmentalism in our modern society, sometimes it's making the environment God. That Mother Nature is just Mother Nature. It's nature. That's our God. And that's why many of you have observed that the atheists who don't believe in the God of the Bible, they have gone to this. They've made nature the God. And says that wherefore we need to honor it. But God's distinct from his creation. We're made in his image, but we're not God. But notice the next section. He speaks about him using the rain, his great wisdom. Thou set a bound that they may not pass over those waters, but here's what happened. When that was in place, and the water's in place, he sent forth springs into the valleys that run among the mountains. What's that for? They gave drink to every beast of the field. The wild asses quenched their thirst. By them the birds of the heavens have their habitation. They sing among the branches. He watereth the mountains from his chambers. The earth is filled with the fruit of thy works. He causeth the grass to grow for the cattle, and herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth fruit, food out of the earth. Notice how man's closely connected with nature. He's connected with the system that the waters go and they bring forth the rain, they return to the seas and all those things. He's talking about that, and all the purpose was to make the grass grow, because God does that, so the beasts can eat, so you can eat, oh man, and bring forth food for you. Now, if I were to take this verse literal, you would not need a lawnmower, man. You just need one to dig out the flower beds. You get cattle to eat the grass. There's your lawnmower. And the herb is for the service of man. But I know that's not what he's talking about. But that's exactly what he said. It's for the grass to grow and the herbs to tend the garden, to tend where you are, so you can produce the particular herbs. That's for man. He works it so he can eat it. So he could eat it. And when you look in Genesis, the 9th chapter, it's not wrong to eat meat. In fact, God says it's for food for you. But you know what the environmentalists say who are religious? They say that was just temporary. Temporary. When so? Jesus, after his resurrection, ate fish. Jesus would observe the Passover and he would eat lamb. Where did this idea come that Jesus was a pita man? It came from people who don't have any regard for the Bible. That's why I'm taking you to the Bible this evening, so you can plant your feet where it needs to be in God's Word and realize that man is part of this creation. He's not trashing it, but he's using it and using the resources. That's what God wants him to do. The third area is God's wisdom. Just think about this thing about light and darkness. And he speaks about this. Thou makest darkness, and it is night. It wasn't just something that, well, we need to have an opposite of day. We'll have night. But he's putting it in its place. When all the beasts of the forest, they creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God. The sun arises, and they get them away and lay them down in their dens. Man goeth forth unto his work and to his labor until the evening. So when the day comes, man's up there working. If I were to take this verse, it's sinful to have shift work. You're only supposed to work in the day, not nighttime. But I'm not doing that. That's not what he's trying to drive at. He said, you know, here's night. And those lions are out there. Those little scavengers out there, and they're doing their thing at night. Sun comes up, man does his thing. Nature and man. Hey, man's the problem. God says they're right there together. As he's producing food for himself. And the earth is full of thy riches. Full of thy riches. Now here's the point that I want to look at as well. Look out at the sea. What do you see? Yonder is a sea, great and wide. Where there are things creeping innumerable. Both small and great beasts. There go the ships. There is the Leviathan, whom thou hast formed to play therein. They all wait for thee to feed them. What do we see? Did you see some guy floating around there on an inner tube so he doesn't have much of a carbon footprint? He sees ships. And he sees a Leviathan, which may have been the whale, or may have been some dragon, but it's some sea monster. And they're both in the same water. You know what? The man looks at the sea, it's shipping lanes. It's just a play place for the whale, or for the great fish, or the beast. And there's room for him. And there's room for those little shrimp in the cold water that he eats, that now says is the best fish oil that you could ever eat. And you can see it from outer space. You can see those Creole shrimp. And there's abundance of them. The whale, that's all he eats. Big old whale. Big old sea monster. He's playing in the field that you're shipping on. And it's okay. There's room for both. You can have your industrial. And you can have the sea lanes and make sure as you bring this part of the world under control and use it for your purposes. God does not ignore that. You see the ship and you see Leviathan. And what you're seeing is that they're both sharing the sea. No way. Man, get out of the way, because nature is having the problems. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot of that comes from people who don't believe in God. And they make nature their God. And we're supposed to be environmentalists. But when we look at God's creation, what we see are the fact that we can be together. We're not to trash it. So what should you do? Should you start saving your paper and trying to limit the paper that you use? Should you start riding your bicycle instead of driving your car? Should you recycle all of your plastic? Should you say, oh, I don't want paper because that's chopping down trees? Trees grow. They're replenishable. Oh, paper, plastic. Don't what to do. What does the environmentalist say to do? Ladies and gentlemen, you can do all those things. You can do what you want to. But when we come to the point that somehow animals are having a better place than man, or they're having the same equal status as man, we've gone from the Bible to whatever man's agenda is. And we don't, when we say, well, I'll just use this world to my benefit, and the greediness of all that, that's not a point. We don't trash it. We take care of it. We're stewards. I think that's what the Bible teaches. But everywhere, man was to bring nature under control to serve his purposes. I think we can do that with all of our resources that we have. If we want to go wind, if we want to do this, or oil, or natural gas, hey, man can use his ingenuity and the necessary things in order to accomplish that. But see, environmentalism says you're a sinner if you use CO2 too much. When in reality, it's 3-4% of all the things, and that is only 3-4% of all the melons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But that's the big thing today. But there's debates about that. And all I wanted to do is set forth in all the debating is realize, no, I'm not going to take on all the things about environmentalists, and I'm surely not going to allow the Bible to be perverted in order to establish your agenda religiously. But I do know I was put here as man to have dominion and to subdue a world that is really against me, well, about nature. And I think we've done that. And there's nothing wrong with industrialization to accomplish that. If we want to clean up things and make things better, that's fine. Using ingenuity to accomplish that. But I'm also not going to separate myself from nature and say, I've got to get out of the way because I'm the problem. We can exist together. Leviathan and the ship. Herbs tilling it and the animals eating the grass. We can all exist together. Psalm 104 tells me that. It tells you that. And I hope we'll be the type of people that says, I'm here and I'm going to take care of the environment I'm around. Do what I can to preserve it, but not say it's sinful to preserve it for my purpose. Because the Bible does not teach that. In fact, it teaches the opposite. This evening, you've heard a lesson that is not telling you what to do to be saved. But it's dealing with the life that we live in and how the Bible is used in order to promote popular agendas. But the Bible was written in order to us to understand what must I do to be saved. The first sin drove man out of the garden and kept us from the tree of life. And the book of Revelation says now you can enter into that city and partake of that tree of life. What's all that about in the between the times? It's the plan of salvation. That God would send forth his son Jesus Christ to die for our sins and be raised on the third day and declared to be the Son of God with power, that we could put our confidence that he is the one that I can be saved by. And it's his name that we only have salvation. Acts 4, as we see in verses 11 and 12. Tonight you could put your trust in Jesus Christ and follow his teachings and realize that one day there's a great day coming. That's not 2012, maybe, but it's not that movie. And when we're going to sing, there's a great day coming. It's not apocalyptic saying, we're going to destroy this earth because we've disgraced the earth and God's going to judge us. He will judge us. It's going to be far more serious than being engulfed with water and no place to live upon this planet. We're going to be standing before the judgment seat of Christ. You're going to give an answer. What did you do with Christ? What did you do in your body? Whether it be good or evil, you'll give an answer. And depending upon how you live, that judgment will end up with us going to heaven, where there's bliss, not this earth, but also going to hell, where is eternal damnation and separation from God forevermore. And it's a choice that you make right now that can determine your eternal destiny. We encourage you, make the choice for Christ. Come to him, serve him, and take care of your spiritual condition. And let his guidance take care of the West stuff that you do in your life and serving him. Heaven will be your home. Obey the gospel as we stand and as we sing.